Concern for the future is the mark and glory of the human condition. People come and go, but however limited their individual strength, small their contribution, and short their lifespan, their efforts are never in vain, because like runners in a race, they hand on the torch of life. I think I read that last week too, but this, you have to keep that in mind. This is by somebody named Renee Dubois, a woman. And because I think so often we put down how our own importance in creation, and because we don't think we're doing anything big and special. Well, if you read the book of Judges, you wonder how the heck all those people got into the story too. And they got in there because they're human beings. And they're part of the story, just like we are. And a few other things I wanted to start with. And this is out of the New Union Prayer Book called The Gates of Prayer. And this is the Jewish prayer book. There is no room for God in those who are full of themselves. The Jews are brilliant. Wherever you find God's footsteps, there is God before you. To love God truly, one must first love people. If anyone tells you that he loves God and does not love his fellow humans, you will know he is lying. These are all Jewish prayers. Brilliant. A father complained to the rabbi that his son had forsaken God. Rabbi, what should I do? And the rabbi's reply was, love him more than ever. Which is not what Protestants do, or Christians do. If God is not, then the existence of all that is beautiful and good is but the accidental byproduct of blindly swirling atoms, or of the equally unpurposeful mechanisms of present-day physics. A man may believe that this dreadful thing is true, but only the fool will say in his heart that he's glad it's true. For to wish there would be no God is to wish that the things which we love and strive to realize and make permanent should be only temporary and doomed to frustration and destruction. Atheism leads not to badness, but only to an incurable sadness and loneliness. One who has never been bewildered. No, I don't want to read that one. This one's a little bit. No, I'll save that longer one. Religion is essentially the act of holding fast to God. And that does not mean holding fast to an image that one has made of God, nor even holding fast to the faith in the God one has conceived. It means holding fast to the existing God. The earth would not hold fast to its conception of the sun if it had one, nor to its connection with it, but to the sun itself. I shouldn't have read that. One last one. This is a little bit long, but especially looking at Judges, I want us to understand that there's a reason why that whole book is in there. Whether or not we know it, what we really mean when we say a God is dead is that the images of God have vanished, and that therefore an image which up to now was regarded and worshipped as God can no longer be so regarded or worshipped. For what we call gods are nothing but images of God, and must suffer the fate of such images. They will die. But Nitschke manifestly wished to say something different, and that something different is terribly wrong in a way characteristic of our time, for it means confusing an image, confusing one of the many images of God, that are born and perish with the real God, whose reality men could never shake with any one of those images, no matter what forms they might honestly invent for the objects of their particular adoration. They will fail. God is too big. Time after time, the images must be broken. The iconoclasts must have their way. For the iconoclast is the human soul which rebels against having an image that can no longer be believed in, elevated above the heads of humanity as a thing that demands to be worshipped. Don't ever let anybody else tell you who God is, in other words. In our longing for a God, we try again and again to set up a greater and a more genuine and more just image, which is intended to be more glorious than the last one and only proves in the big picture to be unsatisfactory. The commandment, "Thou shalt not make unto thee an image," means at the same time, thou cannot make an image of God. Nobody can capture God. This does not, of course, refer merely to sculpted or printed images, but to our own fantasy, to all the power of our imagination as well. But we are forced time and time again to make images and forced to destroy them when we realize we haven't succeeded. Our understandings, in other words, our understanding of God changes as we grow. That's what this is saying. The image is toppled, but the voice is never silenced. The voice speaks in the guise of everything that happens. Pay attention to what happens. In the guise of all world events. It speaks to the men and women of all generations, makes demands upon them, summons them to accept their responsibility. It is of the utmost importance not to lose one's openness. Never feel like you have all the answers. But to be open means not to shut out the voice. Call it what you will. It does not matter what you call it. All that matters is that you hear it. Be spiritually sensitive. Be open. And boy, I am learning this, teaching this time through at this time in my life. What occurred to me today, not today, this week, when I was thinking after I'd look over the book of Judges and all these people, you know, that are part of our heritage story, which is what the Bible is, I realized that not only is the Bible, does the Bible give us in the Old Testament that whole grid for getting out of enslavement, slogging through the Red Sea, going into the wilderness, and then to the Promised Land as a grid for life, so you know where you are in life. It also gives us another grid, and this is the one that occurred to me yesterday. The first five books of the Bible are the beginning stages of life. For all people, they, you know, coming out of enslavement is birth, coming through the birth canal, being born. Those first many years of your life, you need structure, you need instruction, you need guidance, you need ritual, you need all those things that glue life together. That's the first five books of the Bible. Then you move on into your teen years, and then you get into conquest and the judges, and you're reaching around trying to find, you know, who's your leader? You know, think back to what being a young teenager is like, and a young adult even. Who is your leader? What's your job? You know, all of those questions, everything's up for grabs. Nothing is set. Nothing is settled. You're just groping around trying to make your way through life. And that is what goes on through this next section of the Bible. Who's our leader? Well, the person who's the big winner in battle, it becomes a judge, the leader. Nothing is holding them together, all of them, under one kind of leadership except this belief in God. And that's the beauty of Judges. I'll jump ahead with this right now. You go through the history of all those crazy people, and they are, including Deborah, you know, but she puts down all of her fellow brothers and sisters, brothers, because they don't help her when she's in battle. The Song of Deborah is a great sarcastic song. I mean, it's all sarcasm, and we'll look at that. But you get through all of that messiness, and then there's this sweet little story about Ruth. And Ruth shows all of those guys up because she is faithful. She remains faithful. Her husband dies, and she won't leave her mother-in-law because her mother-in-law loves God. And Ruth has learned to love God also. I mean, they were brilliant when they put the Old Testament together because she is in there to show you what's been going wrong all these years, you know, several hundreds of years. I can't remember how many hundreds of years. I've got it written down. 220 to 226 years of Judges. That's how long that book was. Now, think about that. Do you even know your relative that lived 220 years ago? No. You know, well, Bill Hofmeyer does because he did his...
As long as America's been here.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that's how long they lived with a leader rising to the forefront because of having the needed abilities at the time. And what was missing all the time was they did what was right in the sight of their own eyes. And then somebody would rise up and be the leader, and things would calm down a little bit for a while. You look at those judges, and if we have time, we'll look at each one of them a little bit. But every one of them displays a different part of human nature. And I guarantee if you look at them through those eyes, you will see people you know in every one of those people, and maybe even yourself. It just shows us human nature. It's a fabulous book, you know, if you understand that that's what it's portraying. Every type of human nature has been struggling to remember God, to remember that there's just one God. And nobody gets it right. Nobody gets it in a lasting way. And then we've got this sweet little book of Ruth. You can read Ruth this week because she's this sweet little lady that marries somebody that worships one God, and she marries into the family, and you know, there's more to it than that, but what the reason she's in the Bible is because of her faithfulness. And she kind of balances out all those judges in the book of Judges. I mean, that's the purpose. That is the purpose, that she balances that out. The theme of the book of Judges is in Judges 21:25. But after we get through all these years, we go through the kings, we go through Chronicles, which is another story of the kings, and then we finally get to wisdom literature after hundreds and hundreds of years, and those are our growing up years, our teen years, our adult years, all the experiences that take place. Then we get to the wisdom years, and the wisdom is interesting because that comes later in life. But before that, we've got prophets. We got prophets that begin speaking out, and they speak out during all the times of kings. They're all calling people back, you know, to paying attention to who God is, and the person that we know that paid attention to the prophets was Jesus. Jesus didn't have to write his own agenda. All he did was know what the judges said. And the judge in, not the judges, what the prophets said. And Jesus went out and just did what the prophets said the people should be doing. He did everything that the prophets said. He didn't make up anything new. But in doing those things, he broke every single Jewish law. Because the Jews had become just like their surrounding religions. But in the time of Jesus, or before Jesus, the Jews did, they tightened up all the laws. They sold this bill of goods to the Jews, their fellow Jews, that you had to appease God, just like all our surrounding religions had many gods that they had to appease, and did sacrifices and all these things to their gods to make their gods happy. Well, the Jews did the same thing to the Jewish religion. They had all rules and that people, the Jews, had to follow suddenly in order to feel that they were right with God. Isn't that interesting? Because when I push that a step farther, no wonder what happened to Jesus happened during their time in history. I think Jesus shows up all the time in our lives, but just because he isn't hanging on a cross, we don't notice. Where is Jesus in our lives? Jesus is the man that shows us who God is. But in their time in history, they believed to please God, you had to sacrifice God. I'm going to say something that you don't have to agree with, but I've lived long enough and had enough experiences now. I just don't believe that you have to believe in Jesus in order to make God happy. But during their time in history, that's how they understood it, because that's how you always appeased God, by sacrificing. Do you hear what I'm saying? You mull that over. Think about that. We've got the rest of the Old Testament and the New Testament. But I know my experiences with God, and in my lifetime, I just don't believe that anymore. But it was believed then, because that's how they understood God, that God had to be appeased. And God sacrificed his only son. Oh my God.
Do we have to believe that?
I don't believe that.
I hate that.
No, I don't believe that.
That used to make me feel that the world was a very unsafe place to grow up in, if God's killed their own children.
Right. Oh, but that's what they believed.
That's in that time in history.
That is what they believed.
They still do. A lot of people
still
do.
That's right. They do.
Well, you guys said something I always wanted to say.
No, she said it.
But you see, that's why I read some of those things I read ahead of time. And it even came out of the Jewish prayer book. So not every Jew is orthodox, you know, the way we tend to think they are. They have grown along with understanding who this God is. But I picked up this out of my, just happened to see this in my files. This is from a Detroit Free Press in 1998. The scientists say the first humans wandered into the land we now know as Israel more than 100,000 years ago. And you know who they were? The Canaanites. The Canaanites were the first identifiable group, and they have left their mark on every religion since then. Mm. It's a religion of many gods, and we have many gods today, but as we said last week, they're in your pocket, in your wallet, you know, it's power, but during this time when our people are living here in the early Old Testament and the time of Jesus, the surrounding religions all had an organization of many gods. And every god had to be appeased. So, for
That leaked into
Judaism, it leaked into Christianity, so that the only way for people to really believe that this man Jesus was to be reckoned with or recognized as showing us who God was and showing us how God wanted us to live was to put it in a framework that they would understand, because they only understood God as a God you had to appease. Do you hear this?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. This has been pushing me, my mind, all week. And, you know, it doesn't, the beauty of our faith in one God is that we've never stopped hearing that voice. Now, we have different images for that God along the way. The big one for me growing up and still into my adulthood is the Good Shepherd. You know, you can have images, but just don't ever think you've got the final answer. Be open. Be open to noticing, to being aware. The first book about God that was written is our creation. Pay attention to our creation. Pay attention to the birds. I mean, Jack and I keep saying to each other, Max isn't ready to go yet because he's got more to teach us about aging. And he does. He does. You know what Max wants more than anything as an old 126-year-old man? He wants to be touched. He wants to be hugged. He wants to, and he's kissing me all the time under my neck. What do people in nursing homes want? That's exactly what they want and need. And we need to take that seriously. Max is teaching, so when I go to see 99-and-a-half-year-old Lois Nienhuis, I kiss her. And I don't know if anybody else kisses her, but I do. And she loves it. You know, the creation has so much to teach us about God. Never think we have all the answers. Anyway, I can't say that enough. And I just tossed in, knowing I'm risking by telling you what I just said about this whole, the Son of God being, you know, God gave that up for us. Are you kidding? The people, that happened to Jesus, it was predictable. He was breaking every single law of the Jewish religion. And the Jews didn't even have the guts to crucify him. They turned him over to the government and had the government crucify him. The Jews didn't even dare do that. Do you hear that?
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. So this is the beauty of the biblical story, if we could just take our gloves off and look at it in its historical setting. And and I love it. I mean, the people that put this all together were brilliant. They were smarter than most of the people worshiping every Sunday today, because they knew human nature. They knew about what God wants from us, which has never changed, and that is full devotion, full awareness. We don't need proof in order to believe. We just need to be open, and we will be affirmed every step of the way that there's a power out here in this creation that's greater than we can even begin to imagine. I said something to Linda. I said, it makes me want to take that cross down because we narrow it down too much. I think that it'd be bigger to put up maybe a Jesus feeding people or kissing an old person, or, you know, an image that was a doing kind of thing instead of focusing on the death. Do you hear what? Maybe that would propel the church to become the church. I don't know. Anyway, I got way off track there, but this was all part of, this is all part, it isn't off track in a way, because it pushes you to think too, and to hopefully to appreciate this story, and not just read about all these scoundrels and judges and just toss them out. They're in there for a reason. They're in there so we all can find ourselves.
Can you imagine having a father who was a religious fanatic and hearing the story of Jephthah's daughter? That used to scare me to death.
Oh, yes. And the story of Jephthah's daughter, if you didn't. He made a vow.
That's a scary
He made a promise.
To kill his daughter.
The next person through the door.
I was wondering if God thought that, if my father thought it would make God happy, would he kill me? And I grew up with that
feeling. I bet you did. Yeah.
Because he had no logic about him. It was all this fanatical religion.
Right. And that's power. That's power.
I said, but couldn't they have changed that story a little bit?
No.
I mean, he could have changed his mind. No, he promised God, so he had to kill her. And then the poor girl had to agree to being killed. I mean, this is a horrible story.
But that happens today. That's going on today. People are sacrificing family members in all, not necessarily death, but in all kinds of ways. I know what was in the paper. Yes, I think it was yesterday. The Hamilton basketball, girls basketball coach has been there for 16 years, and they have had the best teams. I mean, they've gone to state. They almost won state this year, and he quit. This year, he's done, because he now has a son at Holland High who's going to be playing basketball, and he wants to be able to go to his games. He's giving up this powerful position where he was highly successful for the sake of his family. We don't do that today. I want to send him roses or something and thank him, you know. And that doesn't mean everybody has to do that, but that's a perfect example of just the opposite. Mm-hmm. Because there are too many people that are just like Jephthah.
Fanatical religion is dangerous.
Oh,
you know, it's really a sin. It's a black power.
Right. Well, my grandfather in Chicago was a head Mason and refused to be part of organized religion for the reason that you're saying.
People talk about the plan of salvation, and you try to break into that anyway, and you're ruining the plan of salvation. Well, that plan of salvation is pretty ugly. Right?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. And it's man-made. You know,
those
rules are, that's not my God.
Mm-mm. Well, the idea is that you're compelled to accept Christ because he died for you.
Right. That's
and
power,
it's
isn't it?
Over and over again. Mm-hmm. Died for you, only for you.
Right.
If you were the only person on earth, he died for you. So yeah. It's like, it's hard to reject that because it uplifts you as so important.
Right.
And
right.
You can't.
And why would you deny that?
Right, right.
But see, that's religion that has gotten to the point where it was when Jesus was born, his religion. You know, all these rules and regulations that make you feel like you're in.
You're in,
and he,
sorry about the weather, the other guys
right,
are out, that's just too bad.
But that's why, you know, I can't say it enough, that you have to be in touch with your own lives. And be in touch with nature and everything. You know, the good, the bad, and the ugly, along with, you know, the high moments. There are going to be low moments. But you know, I've said this before, but, you know, when you're a teenager and you're praying for your dad to live, and he dies when you're I was 16, you know, I don't know. I didn't give up on that God because I was part of a church where it was a little church at the end of the street where all the people were loving and supportive. And I've said it before, I don't think anybody in that church knew if Paul was in the Old Testament or the New Testament. But it didn't matter because they knew how to be the church. And you know, when my mom moved out here 26, 27 years ago to move into Freedom Village, I was working in a church in Wyoming Park, and we told her we'd take her around to churches here because that job was, I was going to wind down on that job, and we would join wherever she wanted to. And Jack one Sunday took her to Christ Memorial and, you know, all these different wonderful places. And Third Reform actually has all the pews from New York City and some church there, and, you know, the history, and brought her here, and this was it. This is the closest thing to my little church at the end of the street in Lebanon, New Jersey, where it's small, people are friendly, they care about you. You know, it's, I really believe this church works pretty well at being the church. And that's what we're going to have to do, or the church is going to go through a time where it's pretty minimal. And because this younger generation is not coming. They are, and I don't blame them because of all the bad press. I mean, look at what's happened in the Catholic Church. Well, those Catholic priests could be in the Book of Judges. I mean, they'd fit, you know, with all their bad behavior. Anyway, anybody else have something they want to say at this point before I move on? So Genesis, oh, here's another quote I found among my stuff. Genesis is an unvarnished account of the messiness of life. This whole, all these first five books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, an unvarnished account of the messiness of life. You know, every kind of personality shows up, and then rules and regulations and rituals and rites and all this kind
Sounds
of stuff.
Like the Catholic Church now, doesn't it?
Oh, it is, yeah.
Rituals and rites. And
right.
God knows what's going on.
But back to, you know, the grid for life, Genesis through Numbers, those are the early years in a person's life. And then Joshua, Judges, etc., till you get to the prophets. Those are the teenage years, early adult years. And then you have the prophets, and those are the kind of middle adult years. And then the wisdom literature, and those are the later years in life. And that's all grouped in there, you know, by people that started putting this Old Testament together about approximately 200 years before Jesus. That's how brilliant those Jews were. They started putting the Old Testament together about approximately 200 years before Jesus. Nothing was put into cement in terms of the Old Testament until after Jesus. And that was because of fear that this new wave kind of belief was going to take over and wipe out the whole Jewish religion. Interesting. I mean, it just gives me so much more respect for the writers of the Bible, just to know how brilliant they were. The Israelites, all through their history now, you find they go back and forth. They need separation in order to find their identity, but that's the push and pull of life. Separation and then back into And you know, we talk about that today when we talk about the need to meditate. That is separation. We need those times alone, those times alone individually, corporately. We need separation for the sake of identity, and then we need to be back in the thick of things. Judges is a book of confusion. The theme of the book of Judges is the very last line in the book. In those days, there was no king in Israel. See, and all the little groupings of people around them had kings, and they're thinking, if we had a king, we'd do better. Every man did what was right in the sight of their own eyes. Every man and woman did what was right. Everybody's on their own. It says man in my Bible, but it should be men and women in today's age. Every man and woman. But in those days, women had no value.
Except Deborah.
How did
she make it?
Yes. Let's look at Deborah since you're talking about her. Judges, here, let me hand these out for you. I've given you a little outline of the book of Judges, so it's Yahweh had been the God of the wanderers for hundreds and hundreds of years, but now these people are going to live attached to the soil, and now there's confusion. And the closest thing I can think to make that comparison is what it's like to get married. You know, you've lived on your own, or you've lived in your parents' house, and then all of a sudden you're living with this person. You know, the adjustments that have to be made. Israel's struggle was now for survival. And the conquest actually, you know, when they moved into the Promised Land, the conquest actually took years and years and years. And they never completely took that piece of land. So here are all the judges. Caleb, we'll back up. Caleb, chapter 3, he was actually the younger, Othniel, is the first judge, Othniel, who is actually Caleb's younger nephew. There's a family connection, and they're making a point by saying that Caleb was one of the two spies, along with Joshua, that went into the Promised Land and came back saying, "We can take it." The other 10 spies said, no, we can't do it. They're bigger and stronger. So Othniel is related to Caleb, which gives him some prestige. I don't think we need to read much more about him, but Ehud, the big thing about Ehud is that he was left-handed. So when he makes a vow with the king of the land that he's trying to overtake, he shakes his hand with his right hand and stabs him with his left hand. He can do it because he's left-handed. I know. I mean, it's nuts. But, I mean, when you realize what the writers are trying to do, then it makes sense to have all these crazy people in here, because they all represent us. But the Deborah story, the Deborah, a prophetess, was judging Israel at the time. She used to sit under the palm of, I don't want to do all that. She's a sweetheart. The people that they're fighting against have chariots of iron, which tells you a lot about their power.
Their technology.
And Jael, you know, is part of the story. And she, Jael is the wife of Heber, a Kenite. And she's the one that drives a tent stake right through his temples. One, you know, these are just great people. And while Deborah's out there leading the whole thing, she comes back and she sings a song, and it's all sarcasm. And it's too long for me to read, but starting at verse, chapter 5, I'm in verse 15 in the middle. Among the clans of Reuben, like, she doesn't say, where the heck were you? But she says, there must have been great searchings of the heart, you Reuben people, because you didn't show up. Why did you tarry among the sheepfolds? To hear the piping for the flocks? Do you want to hear the music? Is that why you weren't? This is sarcasm at its best level. And among the clans of Reuben, there were great, so she says it again. Gilead stayed beyond the Jordan, and Dan, why did he abide with the ships? You know, he was always playing with toy ships as a child, probably. And he just loved the ships, so he didn't show up. Asher sat still at the coast of the sea, settling down by his landings, you know, looking over all of his land. And Zebulun is a people that jeopardized their lives to the death, Naphtali. I mean, that's all sarcasm. Sarcasm that's fabulous, actually. And then moving on to Gideon. Gideon destroys the altar of Baal, and he's now called Jerubbaal. That's a Canaanite name. You know, they don't come right out and tell you that he's polluted by the Canaanite religion. They just give him a Canaanite name and expect you to fill in the blanks. He's a good leader. He's loved by the people. People want leadership to stay in the family. He reminds the people that God's, and then Gideon dies. So Gideon does a half-decent job. Abimelech, son of Gideon, wants to rule. But Jotham, the son of Gideon, tells a fable. This is a great one. I like this one. In chapter 9, verse 7. When it was told to Jotham, he went and stood on the top of Mount Gerizim, Jotham, and cried aloud and said to them, It's Gideon, Abimelech wants to rule, but Jotham hears that Abimelech's going to, and this is what Jotham says. Listen to me, you men, that God may listen to you. The trees went forth to anoint a king over them, and they said to the olive tree, which was the king of all trees. It blossomed beautifully, it was strong. The wood was hard, the olives were needed. But the olive tree, when the olive tree was asked to lead over them, the olive tree, not me. Shall I leave my fatness by which gods and men are honored and go and sway over the rest of those trees? And the tree said then to the fig tree, coming down a notch, come and reign over us. But the fig tree said to them, shall I leave my sweetness and my good fruit and go sway over those other trees? Not me either. And the tree said to the vine, this is really low now, come you and reign over us. But the vine said to them, shall I leave my vine which cheers gods and men and go and sway over the trees? Then all the trees said to the bramble, you know, that's what you clean out in the spring and get rid of in your yard. Come you and reign over us. And the bramble said to the trees, if in good faith you're anointing me, I know a person like this. Me? Of course I do it. You know, geez. With absolutely no skills to do it. If you in good faith are anointing me king over you, then come and take refuge in my shade. What kind of shade does a bramble have? But if not, let fire come out of the bramble and devour me. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff in here. humorous stuff in here too. And that's the fable that Jotham tells to show the people how stupid they were by who they were choosing. And then there's Jephthah. An outcast takes over for a while, and Jephthah makes that deal with God. He says it's with God, because that's his understanding. That doesn't mean it's so. You know, just help me win this whole thing that's going on, this battle, and I promise you, the next person that comes through the door is yours. I'll sacrifice him. And then his daughter came through the door. Moving on to chapter 13, we've got the miraculous, first one since in the beginning of Genesis, the first birth story, the miraculous birth story. Manoah and his wife, he from the tribe of Zorah, the tribe of the Danites, whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had no children. And we've heard this story before. Just because you're barren or you're too old doesn't mean you can't have a child. And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, "Behold, you're barren, have no children," and so forth. And then if you take a big long line down from angel, way down in chapter 10, the woman ran in haste and told her husband, "Behold, the man who came to me the other day told me that I'm going to have a baby." So it was an angel, and then it was a man. It's all your perception. It's all a matter of your perception. Be careful who you call angels in your life. But then she gives birth, and the birth is to Samson. And automatically we know that Samson is going to be somebody special in the story, because it's a birth story that shouldn't be happening. But if you read about Samson, he's a very spoiled little boy, and they give him everything he wants. And Samson is hated and is poisoned wherever he goes. Then we've got the Samson and Delilah story. And Samson becomes a Nazarite and grows his hair and doesn't drink. So that goes way back into the wilderness days, the Nazarites, the people that wanted to be symbols of God. And he walks around puffing up his chest because he's representing God. And then he meets Delilah, and she is his match, and she makes a deal with him and finally gets him to do what she wants him to do. And then when he's sleeping, she shaves him, and he's lost all of his power. He no longer has the power to represent God. And it's a Christ-like story. It's Samson's sacrificial attitude, though, that saves him. You know, they eventually capture him, and they put him in between, attach him to pillars of a building and taunt him. And finally, you know, he sees the error of his ways. And Samson calls out to God as he's there, hanging like this, "O Lord God, remember me, I pray you, and strengthen me, I pray thee. Only this once, O God, may I be avenged upon the Philistines for one of my two eyes." He gets his eyes gouged out. And he says, "Let me die with the Philistines, God. Take out the Philistines. And if that means that the whole building comes down and kills me, so be it." This is the first Christ story in the Bible. This is definitely a man that saw Jesus never had to look at the errors of his ways. He just broke all the rules on purpose and had no, you know, he didn't ever want to say, "I'm sorry about that." But Samson realizes that his ego was much too big for him. And he then sacrifices himself for the sake of the rest of the people. That's his redeeming quality. So there's fighting going on among the tribes. A new kind of leadership is needed and desired by the people. They are screaming, you know, give us a king. Everybody around us does so much better than we do. And they have kings, and we want a king. And next week we get into the kings. You know, we do get into that leadership. The Baal religion taught man to control their gods. We see Samson in those final moments of his life, according to the storyteller, giving up power, giving up all of his power, being willing to sacrifice himself. That's what we're all called to do. Not kill ourselves or allow ourselves to be killed, but to have that attitude that it's not about us, and it's not about us controlling God. You know, I think it would be interesting sometime to do some thinking about prayer, because I do think prayer can become something that we're trying to control God, tell God what to do, instead of just dumping our crap on God, you know, and letting it lay. We're telling God what to do. So we're not far off from being part of the Baal religion. You know, this history is worth it. It's worth it if you can see it for what it is. Go for it. Anybody need to take a break? Feel free. Now's the time. If he doesn't go into the bathroom phone booth right next door.
There was this gal in the mountains, and she had been, her name was Delilah, mm-hmm. and she had been married by some snake handling minister, and he left her stranded on top of a mountain with some little baby and didn't ever come back. And so she was kind of a character around town, and she'd come into the gallery. She always wore these enormous false eyelashes. I mean, really stuck. I said, "Whoops! I see some eyelashes. Delilah must not be far behind."
They drop off.
Yeah. She loved that. She
found it
really funny.
Oh, well. Anyway, any other comments?
How can you say that Samson was a prototype of Christ? In that he sacrificed, did Jesus know he was sacrificing himself for what?
Jesus, in the context of the story, I see Jesus not being willing to apologize.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
For anything that he did.
Yeah.
He wanted to show the truth.
Yeah, well, you see the writings of Jesus, I mean, the quotables, for if you confess mm-hmm. them, they are all very solid.
Mm-hmm.
He was not claiming to be mm-hmm. the special Son of God. Mm-hmm. He was just saying, my Father and yours.
Right.
He taught us to say, our Father. He didn't
right.
say, my Father who art in heaven.
Right.
He was our Father.
That's right.
When I hear this only begotten Son of God, I always shiver a bit. I mean, what is this all about?
No.
Where do people go off the track?
Well, it's all about church history. And
yeah,
power.
Yeah.
You know, you tell people what it means. You have power. And, you know, that's the interesting part of what's going on in the Catholic Church right now, because they've had so much power over the lives of people for mm-hmm. over 2,000 years. And look at what's happening.
It's dangerous. Yeah.
Look at what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Their people are human beings. And their humanness is hanging out all over, and it's not pretty.
Breaking all that faithful.
That's right. Right. That's right. And
covered it up.
Yes.
That's
the other piece of that power. It's all about power and ego, and we all get caught up in that. I mean, every generation does.
Did you hear that this morning out of NPR? They were talking about, they're uncovering a lot of this terrible misuse of the nuns.
Yes.
Just awful.
Yes.
Awful subjugation mm-hmm. of the nuns.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I really, you know, I've always thought the Old Testament's interesting. But all of a sudden, in this time through it, I'm thinking, this is powerful stuff. Mm-hmm. This is our story. Mm-hmm. This is, they purposely put all that in there so we could find ourselves. And in every generation, human nature never changes. And the thread that goes through this whole story is this, that we are being called to be faithful. Faithful to a power that's greater than ourselves. And nobody has a cornerstone on it. Nobody. We've had all these stories. That's why I encourage you to look at your own story. Because you've lived long enough, through enough stuff, you know, to trace the threads. What are the threads that have held you together as a human being? You know, nobody can answer that for you except you. And here's another. I've got a high school friend that lives in New Hampshire, and we were cheerleading captains for 4 years in high school. We're still really good friends, and we are in touch with each other all the time. And just yesterday, she must have spent this winter, because they even get more snow than we do, writing her family history. She sent the whole thing to me yesterday. I haven't had time to read it because it's pages long, but I thought, she's doing exactly what we all should be doing. You know, look, and she has family. She has a father. Both parents were born in Germany, but her father, and they were Germans, but they fought the Nazi group, and they were in a concentration camp. And they got out of Germany at the end of the war, and one of her father's names was Adolf. This long string of names. And they lived in Staten Island, New York. And this was in the early 40s, after they got out of Germany. Somebody with human feces put a swastika on their front door. You know, I mean, think about that. You know, that, but it's interesting, you know, to go back and look at your stories. So then the family moved out into New Jersey, in the area where we lived, to get away from all that. But I'm more than ever committed to the fact that your own family story will inform you more than anything else. Somebody else cannot tell you who God is. That's why I read some of that in that Jewish prayer book about your images of God will break, and they should, as you grow. Your image needs to change. It needs to enable you, you know, to grow up. And not all of us have images like you do, my dear friend. But we all have images that have been given to us, that, and we need to find our own. And the thing that just impresses me more than ever is how long this whole concept of one God has been around. With all of the faults that have come through all the stories, and all the stories that we have, and all the brokenness that we all have in our lives, somehow that thread stays.
It's like it's a big tree. God is this big tree, and it keeps growing all kinds of branches. Mm-hmm. You have to keep trimming them off. I even cringe when I hear people teaching children to pray to Jesus.
I know, instead of God.
Yeah.
The beauty.
They have to grow out of that.
Well, I understand it because of understanding my father's Jewish friend, who used to constantly say, "You don't know how lucky you are. You have a man to look at instead of history."
Well, now that's a different thing. That's not a God, is it?
Well, the man
is
showing us who God is. You know.
Yeah, that I can get. But not to deify that person.
No, no. But I can see power. If you image Jesus, that's a powerful thing.
Somebody said to me, do you have any problem with the deity of Christ? I said, I don't have any problem with the deity of you.
That's right.
You are also a child of God.
Good for you. You know, you're great. You dare to say it all.
Well, I have to think about these things.
You do. You do. The security of Israel lay solely in the covenant, that promise, which is amazing that in the time of Judges, which is hundreds and hundreds of years after the story of Abraham, and we only count that story because of world history of when there suddenly was swirling this idea of one God, you know, that man. We really don't, nobody was taking notes about that human being. Where did that story come from? You know, we buy into the story because stories tell us about life. They don't have to be literally accurate to be truthful. So, but for all these years, and we aren't even halfway through the Old Testament, this whole thread stays intact, which is amazing to me. But it's through the covenant and the entire community loyalty to this God. No matter what happens, they come back. They come back constantly to this concept of one God, even though many times they're polluting it with other gods. Many times it's being polluted with other gods, because other gods were much more alluring. They were subtle and alluring. They were easily worshipped. They promised you much. They made few demands. They were conveniently followed. And they allowed people to indulge and do whatever they darn well pleased, because then they could just go appease the god and get over it. And that's what it's like. Baal took the covenant strength away from the people, and they wanted both. The people wanted both, but the covenant would only put up with one God. So our people lived through a lot of history, and if we're honest, still today, with something called syncretism, the meshing of two different kinds of beliefs. You know, I'm going to worship God, but in my private life, there's something else that's just as important, if not more important. It's a constant battle for all of us to be balancing and checking, and you know, and especially when things don't go well in our lives, and things aren't ever going to go well all the time. You know, some of us get bad bodies, you know, and we're fighting stuff all the time. Some of us go bankrupt. Some of us are born into poverty. You know, I mean, where's the fairness of all that? But some of my favorite people in life, and I'm glad I didn't miss a couple of these, were people who survived the concentration camps and never lost their faith. Some of my favorite people. How do you keep that? How do you explain that people don't lose their faith? Only as a religion has to meet the challenge of its opposite does it discover its own nature and potential strength. So, all the former Canaanite sanctuaries were converted to religious sites for descendants of Abraham. The Canaanite agricultural calendar was adopted by all our people because it made sense. Gideon's name, I told you that before, was a Canaanite name. Saul's, and we'll get into Saul and David in the next couple of weeks, they were kings. Their children also had Baal names. So that's the Bible doesn't come out and say, notice this, But it's there because you recognize the names. That's why if you study the Bible in its historical setting and study the history around it and be very appreciative of the writers, the Bible comes alive. Very likely, the stories in Genesis, the story of Babel, comes from this time in history. The Baal religion, scorn for a proud culture, you know, shows up in the story of Babel. Cain. Cain is a Cain who built the first city. He was the first murderer, Cain and Abel. Noah, you know, he's holed up in a box for a long time, you know, all those animals. But till the soil and plant the vineyard, which led to drunkenness, if you go back and read that story, and nakedness. And, you know, he's the son of Ham. Canaan was cursed. That lineage is constantly showing up, that, which then helps you to understand this, why people want to be separatists. And I don't justify it, especially this whole white situation that's going on now, but it has deep roots, you know, of wanting to be separate, not wanting to be intermixed. But that's not our God. So, the conclusion in Judges, I better get back to Judges. I've gone all over the place today, but you know, I'm not about to spend a ton of time on all the details of all these people. You can do that yourselves. But to give you the overall understanding of why they're in there, and maybe you're in there and I'm in there, but Judges 2, 20, so the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he said, because these people have transgressed my covenant, which I commanded their fathers, have not obeyed my voice, I will not henceforth drive out before them any of the nations that Joshua left when he died, that by them I will test Israel, whether they will take care to walk in the ways of the Lord as their fathers did or did not. That's interesting. That's interesting. But that's their understanding of God at that point. That doesn't mean that that was God. But when they look back over their history, and why the heck didn't God get rid of all those surrounding peoples for us, that's the best they can do to understand it, to blame it on God. We do the same thing today. You know, they were... So the surrounding people in chapter 3 says they were tested. So there was a good reason for people to be left. That's how they understood it. But I cannot say it enough, that because it's written there doesn't make it true. Understand where the people are in their understanding of God. They're very... Sometime I'll bring in all the stages of faith development for you to see. And you'll see that they're at a very infant stage in understanding who God is. Mm. And the story is at a very infant stage.
You can go through all those stages in your own life.
Yes, you can. And hopefully you will. At least get to one of the higher ones where God becomes...
So
the God of everything.
When you truly understand God, you can't get away from God. Mm-mm. And you don't even want to.
No. And God is everywhere, in everything, no contingencies. You know, it's all about it. But too many, I've often felt like I used to say you shouldn't put a Bible in the hands of people till they're 50. Now I'm beginning to think it's closer to 80. You know? You have to live a slice to really be able to be honest with it. Otherwise, you read it literally. Mm-hmm. Do you hear what I'm... This mm-hmm. is a story not to be taken as the golden rule for today. we're to look at it and recognize where we are.
And sometimes you can recognize things better in retrospect.
Absolutely.
Than you can at the time.
Right. That's right.
You know, you say that's their perception, but sometimes perception in retrospect gets a lot clearer.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what makes the writers brilliant, because they're willing to give us the stories honestly, so that we can see where we are in those stories. Does that make sense? I mean, are you? If it's not, you can blow up my phone, egg my house or something. But that's where I am in life, of being able to really understand, you know, in times of crisis when Israel was oppressed by foes, the people returned, with renewed zeal to the worship of Yahweh. You know, when all was down and gone, you scream out, "My God, where are you?" Very much needed because of the presence of Baalism. As Israel turned to the idols, the covenant was weakened. Then the confederacy was weakened. It was always up to God to raise up a new leader. And God always did and always does. At least they are believing that. And the final one for us is Jesus. And
our kids used to say, "Why? Jesus was such a wonderful and good guy. Why did they kill him?"
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, I could have said, you know, to save the world, but I said because he had some really new, simple ideas about God, and he scared them to death, and they were afraid they'd lose their jobs, so he killed them."
And you're really close to the truth.
Yeah.
You're really, because he was a rebel.
Yeah.
He was not a really nice young man. He was a rebel. He took on every piece of the religious, of the Jewish religion. Every rab. I mean, he even went into the temple and kicked over the money pots, and he did everything he could to leave a legacy that would show us, pay attention to those prophets. He did what the prophets told people to do, and the people never listened.
Because then we've gone and messed him up sometimes. We've polluted the life of Christ by what we put into it.
Yeah.
Have you read the book From Jesus to Christ?
I don't know. It sounds familiar.
It's a brother. It's within the last few years.
Yeah.
I haven't read it either, but I'm just thinking as you're talking that would be an interesting thing to do.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of good stuff out there right now that wasn't out there 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
People are speaking up. You know, and I think I can tell this. Yesterday, when I came for the Lenten class, and Linda was standing outside of her doorway, I said, "What are you out here smoking?" And she said, "No, I saw you drive in. I wanted to let you in my way so you didn't have to find another door." But anyway, I said, "How are you doing?" And she said, "Oh, this is tough. I mean, this is over-the-top stuff." She said, "I can't please everybody. You know, there are too many people that are very upset with the construction, that nobody's going to come to church because they can't get in the front door, and they're not going to want to go around." And I said, "Oh, Linda, they're just still in the first five books of Genesis." And she turned around and looked at me, and I said, "I'm serious. They are still people in those early years that need everything fixed and right and ritual." And I said, "Wait till what they are in is you've pushed them into the Judges, where nobody knows what the heck who's the leader and what's going on." This is interesting.
How do you have construction without
Right. Absolutely. Well, they got pushed into the Judges out of the first five books. You know, and that's what made me start thinking all the more about the layout of the Bible. the Old Testament, because it is. It follows our life development. And it fits right into the grid. I mean, if you're enslaved, you're in the mother's womb, and you got to get out, slog through the, get out of the birth canal, which is like going through the Red Sea, and then you're thrown into the wilderness. And those are those first five books where you set up all the rules and regulations, and you know. And then after that, you're thrown into the teen years and the early adult years, where you got kings and that all that kind of stuff going on. And then you start hearing wisdom.
Then you die.
And you hear the prophets. You hear the prophets first. The prophets come through loud and clear. You know, when you got your kids, you think you got your kids under control, and then you're hearing the prophets, and then they grow up and leave your house. And then you don't know who the heck they are anymore, because you're not tucking them into bed every night. And then you begin to get wisdom. And then you die. It's interesting, isn't it, how it's all put together on a grid that... Anyway, I'll finish. With the image of God, more to the point, however, is an appreciation of Israel's incomplete understanding of God in this early stage of her history. This understanding was a highly primitive one. It would take centuries of revelation through the prophets to develop and mature. For the present, Israel thought of Yahweh as a nationalistic God. As other nations had their special protector gods, so Israel had Yahweh. And any enemy of Israel was automatically an enemy of Yahweh. Moreover, at this point in history, Israel had no idea of afterlife. Isn't that interesting? Afterlife. This would come much later in her history. Therefore, Israel assumed that Yahweh executed judgment upon wicked men, women, enemies, and in this life. Thus, to chastise an enemy was to act as the instrument of Yahweh's justice, a noble occupation. The portrait of Yahweh in the book of Judges was a highly primitive rendering. Yahweh was a god of battles and victories. He ordered wars, took Israel's side, destroys Israel's enemies. Only with the passage of time would this portrait be filled out in full color and refined drastically by the prophets. So we got to keep the book of Judges in its historical setting to fully appreciate. And appreciate, I mean, just like us as human beings, our immature understanding of God. So that makes it easier to tell children to pray to Jesus, because he was a historical person. A whole lot easier. And a gentle person who loved children. You always say the picture of Jesus, let the little children come to me.
Traditional.
Right. No. I'm just saying that because, yeah. You know, that's where it comes from. I think I read this quick one. A student once complained, you tell us stories but never tell us their meaning. And the teacher said, how would you like it if someone offered you fruit and chewed it before giving it to you? No one can find your meaning for you, even the teacher. You have to find your own meaning. Hopefully this is a place where I'm honest enough that opens the door for all of you to be honest about your own understandings. Because then it's yours.